times that in person. So we're looking for historic turnout here in the suburbs.
Can you explain how the motor election vans work?
Yes. So look, when I took office, we wanted to do everything possible to make it easier for people to vote. And one of those things was expanding satellite locations where you can request a mail-in ballot and submit it on the spot. And we decided to create a mobile satellite office, basically a voter van. It's kind of like an ice cream truck where you can submit your ballot. You can register to vote, request it, and submit it all on the spot. And the idea there was to change the story. Right now, people are fearful. They are concerned about the integrity of the election. But in the process of getting out there and educating people, I'm trying to let them know that our exercising our right to vote is something to be celebrated. And so we show up in Montgomery County with our voter van. It's the first of its kind in Pennsylvania. We go to senior centers and college campuses, and we simply make it easy for people to vote on the spot. And of course, the Republicans and their lawyers sued me immediately when we set this up. But thankfully, it continues to roll. We stopped on college campus at Bryn Mawr College here in Montgomery County. I remember being asked by someone on the right, why did you stop at a women's college? I said, well, because women have the right to vote. So we have to remind some folks on the right that, in fact, helping people vote is simply helping us live up to the promise of our democratic ideals.
You mentioned Elon Musk, who promised to give away $1 million a day to voters who sign up with his America PAC. He's been sued by the Philadelphia District Attorney Larry Krasner for calling it an illegal—he calls it an illegal lottery scheme. Can you talk about the effect of this?
So I think one of the ironies about those who are perpetuating the lie that there is widespread fraud are often the people who are committing the fraud. And first and foremost, Donald Trump, in his attempt, as we all know, in Georgia to find 11,000 some votes and to pressure election officials to do so. But now Elon Musk, who's being told by the Department of Justice that his scheme may violate the law and that they're investigating him. And he's also been sued by the District Attorney of Philadelphia for operating an illegal lottery. And fundamentally, it's very clear that they will say and do anything. And it's concerning because if they lose, it's going to really be a question of what their supporters do after the fact. And that's the biggest concern for me right now is if we know on election night, if, say, the Seltzer poll's accurate and Kamala Harris does very well, are any of their supporters going to believe the results, going to trust the results despite the integrity of the process?
I wanted to bring Larry Noble into this conversation, a former general counsel of the Federal Elections Commission. If you can start off by talking about the role of the FEC and what you are most concerned about right now.
The FEC was intended to be the civil enforcement agency for the federal campaign finance laws. It was created in the wake of Watergate. And the idea here was that we have contribution limits, we have limits on what the parties can do. All of it was to control the influence of money in politics. But the FEC over the years has really become more of a roadblock to real campaign finance enforcement than the enforcer. And what we saw is it went through various phases where it was active at one point as three Republicans, three Democrats, and then it became more partisan, where the Republicans became less willing to go after Republicans. And Democrats would still generally vote for enforcement against Republicans and Democrats. And then it went through a stage where it became more ideological, which really means that the Republicans no longer vote for enforcement against Democrats or Republicans. And they just don't agree with the law. And so they're sitting on a commission where they don't agree with enforcing the law. And now we have a Democrat who has been voting more with the Republicans. So we have an agency that's supposed to be enforcing the campaign finance laws, but is not doing it. And it's opening up more loopholes as we go along. And in that context, what really worries me is that we have an election system, and that therefore means a government, which very much favors those with a lot of wealth. Those with a lot of wealth have the ability to influence elections the way that the rest of us don't. And I think it's critically important. I really appreciate the work that Neil is doing. I think what he talked about was very important. But part of my feeling now is, while we have to fight to make sure everybody has the right to vote and everybody who has the right to vote is able to exercise that vote, we have a problem that once candidates are in office, they tend to follow and do what the wealthiest supporters wanted them to do. And we had a system, and we still technically have a legal system, that is supposed to keep all of these super PACs and the spending of all these hundreds of millions of dollars by individuals, keep them away from the campaigns and not have them coordinate in any way with the campaigns. And that's just not what's happening. So I'm concerned about the election administration, and I'm concerned about what happens also because of all the money in politics and how it's basically silencing the voter. The right to vote is sacrosanct. You have to be able to vote if you're eligible to vote. But your vote should mean something later in governance. It should not just then be drowned out by the money that the wealthy and people like Elon Musk are spending.
And what about what Elon Musk is sending? Yes, the Justice Department sent a letter, but it's the local DA in Pennsylvania and Philadelphia who sued. Why isn't this illegal, giving money to people to vote $1 million a day?
I think it is illegal, and there are a lot of election law experts who think it's illegal. There's a federal law against paying somebody to register or urging them to register. And what this is doing is urging people to register by saying that if you're registered in these specific swing states, then you'll be eligible for this lottery. So it really, in my view, violates potentially two laws. One, the federal law about not paying people to register or to urge them to register, and then state lottery laws. And, you know, when I was in private practice, this is something we used to have to advise people. You're not only concerned about the federal campaign finance laws, you also have to be concerned about state lottery laws in these type of situations. So I think he is violating the law. But I think what Musk has shown at this point is that it's not likely he cares about that very much. He's just going to keep going ahead. And I think the bet they're placing is that if they can win, or if they can, after the election, throw up enough objections and get their people rallied and somehow take over, that all of this goes away. They don't have to worry about it anymore.
Can you talk about Citizens United? Also, what happened to the McCain-Feingold? That was Senator McCain, now deceased, and Senator Feingold of Wisconsin of, 20 years ago, 2002?
Right. So what happened was that after the Federal Election Campaign Act was first enacted and the FEC came into existence in 1976, there were more and more loopholes added by the FEC, the Federal Election Commission, to the law and the courts, where we ended up with a system that was not working the way it was intended to work. The political parties were getting what's called soft money, all this money that's not legal under the federal limits and prohibitions. And they were saying they were using it for state elections, but they were really using it for federal elections. McCain-Feingold was supposed to put an end to that. And what it basically said was the party committees can only accept money under the federal laws. It put restrictions on federal candidates and office holders being able to solicit money. They can only solicit money under the federal limits and prohibitions. And it had a number of other provisions. That was really a very strong law. It was immediately challenged in court by Senator McConnell and others. And most of the law was upheld by the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court talked about the importance of having laws that not only get at bribery and quid pro quo type of transactions where you pay somebody directly to do something, but also to get at the large contributions and the appearance of influence and buying access. And they said that undermined democracy. Well, then you moved ahead to 2010 and you had the Citizens United case. The important thing to know about that is that the makeup of the Supreme Court had changed. Sandra Day O'Connor had retired and was replaced. So we're now looking at a new Supreme Court. And Citizens United, for the first time, the Supreme Court said that corporations and labor unions can make unlimited what are called independent expenditures, meaning that they can use their corporate money and spend as much of it as they want on ads for candidates, et cetera, as long as it's independent. What was really concerning about that case, besides the ruling, was the court now said that really what we have to look at is quid pro quo corruption, corruption that is basically bribery, paying somebody. And it undermined what the Supreme Court had earlier said about the importance of dealing with the appearance of corruption that large contributions bring. And the Supreme Court said in the Citizens United case and cases that followed it, said that buying influence and access is not really a problem. It is a feature of democracy. And you expect office holders to be more responsive to the people who contribute to them. And that, again, undermines, in my view, the very concept of democracy, where everybody has the same voice and has the ability to be heard. And you don't have that when you have a situation where the wealthy can just drown out everybody else. And then once the election's over, they're in office, they get greater access to candidates, and they have much stronger influence with candidates. So we're now in a situation.
We have just 20 seconds.
I'll just say very quickly, what they've also undermined completely is the idea of independence of these groups. Elon Musk is supposed to be totally independent of Trump if he's going to spend this money. That's the only reason they allowed it. But instead, we see him at the rallies, and one has a strong suspicion that they are sharing information that will help Musk help Trump.
Larry Noble, former general counsel of the Federal Election Commission, now teaches at American University Washington College of Law. And Neil Makija, Montgomery City Commissioner and Chair of the Board of Elections in Montgomery County, Pennsylvania. You can check out his video essay at democracynow.org and the New York Times. When we come back, we go to Gaza. We'll speak with Save the Children. Stay with us.
Everything you do for love. Just double it and pass it back. Go home. Someone tell me, are you capable to reciprocate? No matter how high or heavy the take, a stick of gold or dynamite, you could plead guilty and now we'll do the
of Gum by Nemesis. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. It was another deadly weekend in Gaza, where UNICEF reports more than 50 children were killed in Israeli strikes on the Jabalia refugee camp in the span of 48 hours. Two residential buildings sheltering hundreds of displaced Palestinians were reportedly leveled in the attack. UNICEF is also demanding Israel launch an immediate investigation after a vehicle driven by one of its staff members came under fire by an Israeli quadcopter flying above Jabalia this weekend. Meanwhile, the World Health Organization said at least four children were injured after Israeli forces dropped a stun grenade on a polio immunization center in Gaza City's Sheikh Radwan district. Israel's attack came despite agreeing to a humanitarian pause in order to carry out the final phase of the polio immunization campaign after it was postponed in October due to Israel's indiscriminate bombardment, siege, and repeated targeting of humanitarian aid workers. This is a Palestinian mother of three, speaking from Gaza City.
I stayed here in northern Gaza along with all my children and came here to give my children the polio vaccine. They were supposed to get it a month ago, but due to the Israeli offensive and the siege, it was delayed a month. We hope it will protect the children against polio. I call on the world to stop the genocide of northern Gaza because we are literally dying. Those who do not die from bombardments are dying from hunger. The situation is catastrophic.
Some 15,000 children under the age of 10 in towns across northern Gaza, including Jabalia, Betlehia, and Beit Hanun, still remain inaccessible and will likely not receive this dose of the oral polio vaccine due to Israel's attacks and blockade. This all comes as 15 humanitarian groups are describing the situation in northern Gaza as apocalyptic, with top UN officials again warning the entire Palestinian population in North Gaza is, quote, at imminent risk of dying from disease, famine, and violence. unquote. The region has been under an Israeli siege for nearly a month while Israel continues to block life-saving humanitarian aid from entering North Gaza. Aid groups fear the humanitarian catastrophe in Gaza will soon worsen as Israel has officially notified the UN that it's cut off ties to UNRWA, the UN Agency for Palestine Refugees. We go directly to Deir al-Balah in Gaza, where we're joined by Rachel Cummings, Save the Children's International Humanitarian Director and team lead there in Gaza. Rachel, can you describe what's happening on the ground and what you're calling for?
Hello, and thanks for the opportunity. We are calling for a ceasefire, a definitive ceasefire. You know, children in Gaza are facing an extraordinary situation. You've described it extremely well in terms of the constant onslaught and bombardment of children in Gaza, in the north, in the middle area, and in the south of Gaza, across the whole of the Gaza Strip. You know, we have over 14,000 children who have been killed. You referenced the 50 children that were killed most recently in an attack in a shelter in the north of Gaza. But this is a constant bombardment, and children are dying every single day. There is not enough food in Gaza. There is not enough water and clean water for people in Gaza. The situation is absolutely desperate.
And so what exactly has to happen in at this moment? Describe the level of aid you can get and the polio immunization programs being stopped because of the bombardment.
You know, the fact that the center that was providing the polio vaccines was attacked at this time is unfathomable. It's extraordinary that that event has happened. And, of course, that will have a knock-on effect and an impact, not only of the people that were impacted at that time, but then the faith and the trust for women and parents and family members to take their children to health centers. You know, it's very important, obviously, the children to be vaccinated, but with the attacks on healthcare that are persistent, people will have lost faith and trust in the safety or the presumed safety of going to healthcare facilities to receive vaccines. So the knock-on effect on that will be massive. Now, what we need is improved access to humanitarian supplies, bring supplies in to Gaza, and then, of course, safe passage of those supplies and of our teams to be able to then reach the populations who are most in need. Everyday humanitarian workers, Save the Children staff, our partners, and other humanitarian workers across the whole of Gaza are literally risking their lives to deliver life-saving services for children and their families. This is an extraordinary and a very unique situation that we're seeing in Gaza. To be a child in Gaza, and I'm in Deir al-Balah, at the moment in the middle area of the Gaza Strip, but it's a miserable existence for children. They're living under this constant fear. They've had no formal education for over 12 months now. So that normalcy of life, that routine and education provides a degree of protection for children, not only for their physical health, but also for their mental health. We're deeply, deeply concerned about the mental health of 1 million children in Gaza. Every single child in Gaza has been affected by this war.
And if you could comment more on the targeting of humanitarian aid workers and Israel now officially notifying the UN it's cut off ties with UNRWA. How important is UNRWA in getting aid to and being observers on the ground to what's happening there in Gaza where you are?
It's hard to quantify or describe how important, how essential UNRWA is for the humanitarian endeavor, the humanitarian response in Gaza. But Gaza is, and has been for many decades, of course, wholly reliant and integrated within UNRWA, or rather UNRWA is integrated within the whole of Gaza and the Palestinian population. So as humanitarian agencies, we heavily rely on UNRWA to receive fuel, to support on coordination of access and movement of supplies. So UNRWA are a huge provider of life-saving services. Every day, They're providing over 15,000 consultations in the health facilities. Hundreds of thousands of people are living in the UNRWA-designated shelters that were previous UNRWA schools. Every sort of strand of society is wrapped up with UNRWA. So the cessation of UNRWA in terms of providing humanitarian life-saving support to the population here is extraordinary to even consider.
Rachel Cummings, I want to thank you so much for being with us. Save the Children's International Humanitarian Director and Team Lead in Gaza, speaking to us from Deir al-Balah. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Both Donald Trump and Kamala Harris campaigned in the battleground state of Michigan over the weekend, where they sought support from Michigan's 200,000 Arab American and Muslim voters, many of whom who've denounced U.S. support for Israel's war on Gaza. Kamala Harris addressed supporters at a massive rally in East Lansing, Michigan. She began her address with a nod to civilian victims of Israel's war.
This year has been difficult, given the scale of death and destruction in Gaza, and given the civilian casualties and displacement in Lebanon. It is devastating. And as president, I will do everything in my power to end the war in Gaza. To bring home the hostages, end the suffering in Gaza, ensure Israel is secure, and ensure the Palestinian people can realize their right to dignity, freedom, security, and self-determination.
Visited East Lansing after President Trump traveled to Dearborn Friday, marking the first time a leading presidential candidate visited the Arab American majority city. Trump was questioned by reporters.
Sir, what conversations did you have recently with Prime Minister Netanyahu about bringing peace to the Middle East?
We had a good conversation. We're going to bring peace. You're going to have peace in the Middle East, but not with the clowns that you have running the U.S. right now. You're going to have peace. You're going to have peace in the Middle East, and they should have peace in the Middle East, but not with the clowns you have in the Middle East. Let me tell you what you have. You have people in the Middle East that aren't doing their job, and you have people in the U.S. that aren't doing their job. And when they get it together, when they get it right, you're going to have peace in the Middle East.
For more, we go to Dearborn, Michigan, to speak with Mayor Abdullah Hamoud, who refused to meet with President Trump, but has also declined to endorse Kamala Harris. Mayor, welcome back to Democracy Now! First, explain your decision not to meet with President Trump.
Yeah, I'm not somebody to be fooled by President Trump. I think we very clearly understand where Donald Trump falls on the issues. This is the president that ushered in the Muslim ban, that wants to be the architect of the Muslim ban 2.0. This is somebody that annexed the Golan Heights, somebody that eliminated all funding for the Palestinian humanitarian causes and issues within the congressional budgets. This is somebody that provided Saudi Arabia with the arms to kill over 30,000 people, innocent civilians in Yemen. And so I'm not here to be fooled by President Donald Trump. And so I refuse a meeting with Donald Trump out of principle, because that is not my president.
And talk about your position on Kamala Harris, who just addressed this massive crowd in East Lansing.
You know, for the last almost over a year now, what we have been calling for is for a ceasefire and to achieve a ceasefire by the appropriate means. And based on all the conversations that we've had, based on historical knowledge of how ceasefires were achieved, there has to be the willingness of the president to pick up the phone and to demand from Benjamin Netanyahu, that war criminal and his cabinet, to achieve a ceasefire. And you have to be willing to impose an arms embargo. What we have not yet heard from this president is the willingness to enact an arms embargo. And I think that is the frustration that many of us have. Yes, we want to ensure that Palestinians have the right to self-determination and take it a step further. We want to ensure that Palestinians have a just state of their own. I think that is what's extremely important to also call out. But what we have not seen in the policy that has been pushed out by the vice president is if she will go about or how she will go about in accomplishing this.
You are Lebanese American. Can you talk about what's happened to your family in Lebanon?
My family has been displaced. The first Lebanese American citizen that has been killed was a Dearborn resident, a very close family friend's father, Hashkem Jawad. My wife has lost several family members now, one of whom was a paramedic who was assassinated as he was trying to help others. There is a blanket of grief now in the city of Dearborn, where folks are attending funeral services, offering condolences to family by the masses. I'm attending services not for one or two individuals, but for 12 and 20 on any given day. Celebratory events have been postponed. This is the climate right now in the city of Dearborn. And so when folks come here to knock on doors or to ask how people will vote, you have to understand for many, almost everybody I know has now lost a loved one or know a loved one who has been injured or displaced or whose ancestral home has been decimated. That is the current climate right now in the city of Dearborn.
Have you ever met with Vice President Kamala Harris?
There have been many conversations across campaign teams, and there's been many conversations going back to even when President Biden was the presidential the nominee for the Democratic Party. What I would say is we have made our position points very clear. We've been communicating very clearly, whether it was with senior White House staffers or with the campaign officials, about where we stand on these issues. And if there's an unwillingness to move off of the genocide for Gaza, off of enabling and funding this genocide that is being conducted across Gaza and now encroaching within Lebanon, then there is an unwillingness for us to step forward and endorse any candidate. You know, my loyalties, first and foremost, are to the people of my community, the people of this city, of this district. And so we're willing to put people over party, first and foremost, to ensure that we utilize the platform that has been entrusted to us by the people to elevate their voices in this time of need.
And to those who say they cannot support Kamala Harris or Donald Trump, some not voting, others voting for a third-party candidate like Jill Stein, your response to also those who then say that a vote for Jill Stein would be a vote for Trump?
Given the level of grief that you just hear about on a daily basis within this community, my main concern is to ensure that people come out and cast their ballots and vote. Apathy, I think, is the most destructive thing. People forget in 2016, it wasn't that Donald Trump won by less than 11,000 votes. It was the fact that 80,000 people had skipped the presidential question. And so my job, first and foremost, what I have endorsed is that people come out and vote, to not sit on a sideline, regardless of all that has unfolded and happened to you directly or indirectly. What I can assure you is that sitting on the sideline will accomplish nothing. And so I've called on people to vote their moral conscience, to go out, to at least begin with the local ballot questions, the local elections, and then work their way up to the ballot as they get to that presidential question.
You, Abdullah Hamoud, are the first Arab American and first Muslim mayor of Dearborn. You have stressed that it's not only about a presidential election, it's about the local level. Can you talk about what this election means for you? For Rashida Tlaib of Detroit, outspoken supporters of Palestinians, of Lebanese, of against Israel's war on Gaza.
What you have heard over the last year is this community taking a principled position. This was the community in which the Uncommitted Movement was founded and blossomed organically across this country. But what you're hearing from many of our residents, from many of our constituents, from the anti-war, anti-justice movement, or pro-justice movement, excuse me, broadly speaking, is that this is a community that says, if we want to end gun violence and mass shootings in schools within the states, then we must also be willing to not provide a war criminal 2,000-pound J-bombs to decimate every school and university across Gaza. If we want to expand access to healthcare, then we also must be willing to hold to account any government that bombs or decimates every healthcare facility across all of Palestine or across Lebanon. These are the morals and the values that we have. And this is the principal position that we have taken. And this is not just a position that is popular here in the city of Dearborn, but if you look across the polls, across this country, you have seen that the center of America has moved on the issue of Israel and Palestine. And what has yet to be had is the center of the two major political parties in this country to move on the issue as well.
Abdullah Hamoud, I want to thank you for being with us. Mayor of Dearborn, Michigan, just declined to meet with Donald Trump in Dearborn over support of Israel's assault on Gaza, but has not endorsed Kamala Harris, though encourages people to go out and vote. There are apparently six third-party presidential candidates in Michigan. Tune in on election night. That's tomorrow, Tuesday, November 5th, for our Democracy Now! Four-hour election special from 8 to midnight Eastern time on Wednesday, 8 to 10 in the morning a.m. Eastern Time. I'm Amy Goodman. This is Democracy Now!
Hi, this is Jesse Brown, the host of Canada Land, Canada's only media criticism program. Every week I talk to some of the most interesting people in the country about some of the things that matter most. We talk about the news media, about comedy, film, music, and politics. And you can now listen on CJSF 90.1 FM every Monday at 5 p.m. Wait for it.